again to our program, Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology. My guest again is Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High in History and Religion. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick's Church and Chaplain of John Paul II Catholic High. Ron, welcome once again. And we've been discussing how we can use reason, how we can use the wonderful gift of the ability to think that God has given to us to come to a knowledge of the existence of a supreme being, a creator, designer of the universe. So maybe you could just summarize a little bit where we came from last time and how we're up now to proving God's existence from historical argument.
First, we looked at very briefly at some of the logical, rational arguments, especially those of St. Thomas Aquinas' five ways. We didn't spend, as I said, very much time on that because they're fairly difficult, and without a blackboard or some audiovisual aids, it's sort of difficult. Plus, it takes quite a bit of time. Plus, it's not used too much anymore to prove God's existence, although I still think they're very useful.
Very valid.
To some people more than others, of course. And then we looked at Father Aidan Nichols, one of the Dominican priests, and I think one of the world's most prominent theologians today. We looked at six reasons he gave, experiential rather than the more rational intellectual approach, a logical approach, a more experiential, and by experiential you mean, of course, the experiences that people have that lead them to believe that there's a God.
A sense of wonder. Existence of conscience.
Yes.
So those are some of the things we talked about.
Right. And then we had just started in the last session taking a look at Peter Kreef's eight historical arguments to prove God's existence. And again, these are experiential arguments. And Peter Kreef is a philosopher who teaches at Boston College, a Catholic college, really. It's a university in Boston. The historical arguments would be that history itself has various different ways of looking at history, make us conclude that, you know, there has to be something that's involved in history. For example, there's a storyline in history. History is not just something random, that it has a point. We would call it, of course, in Catholicism, divine providence.
Okay.
It's a plan that God has, of course, in salvation history that works itself out. And if you see that plan, it's very, very obvious. It's very evident.
It was evident particularly in the history of God's dealing with the Jewish people,
yes,
the chosen people.
That's correct. And then a second argument he gives is moral design. This is the idea that the hand of God in history, this is fairly obvious to see. And again, an example would be the Jewish people and their history. And then a third argument he gave was coincidences, providential coincidences. I teach a course in world history at John Paul II Catholic High, where we look at certainly dozens of events, major events in the history of the world, the same events they would look at North High School or South High School or West Vigo or any secular high school. We look at it in a much deeper sense, in the sense of seeing divine providence operating in these events. Whether it be the early philosophers, Greek philosophers, whether it be like Aristotle or Plato or Socrates, what role did they play in salvation history, for example? Or Alexander the Great. Unwittingly, unintentionally, Alexander the Great was really in the service for doing things that made it easier for Christianity to develop and to spread when the time came, or the development of the Roman Empire and the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Or take Abraham, for example. God had a reason for asking Abraham to go to where he told him to go. And you can carry that through, of course, all the way through history, right on down to the present day.
And, of course, the Old Testament specifically exemplifies they're always seeing the hand of God in the events that happen to them.
Yes, and time again, we encounter these providential coincidences. And then the coincidence in quotations. And a fourth argument that he gives, of course, is miracles. And that's an argument that we're going to spend some time on later on. So we didn't go into it in a lot of detail, but the miracles of the Old Testament, the miracles in the New Testament, the miracles that occurred in the church down through the centuries, and even miracles, of course, that occur today in time and space. In other words, they're things that happened, and so they're historical.
And obviously, if a miracle is something that only can be done by God outside the laws of nature, well, then God must exist.
That's right. There's a saying that if miracles exist, then God exists. It's proof of God's existence.
And that's why many people a priori are just from the beginning say, I don't think miracles exist, period. I don't accept any miracles. Well, because I don't want to accept God.
Typically, the people who take that position, it's a presupposition, and they just, whether it be an historian, there are historians who take that mm-hmm. position, there are theologians who take that position, lots of them. We'll encounter perhaps some of those a little bit later on in our series.
From my understanding, it's sort of like a person saying, it's impossible to put a man on the moon. And just ignoring the fact that it has been done.
Yes, it has
done. I just don't believe that.
Well, then Peter Kreef goes on to a fifth argument that we didn't get into, and that is Christ himself.
I thought he expressed that very well.
Yes. He's a man, according to Kreef, a man who lived among us and claimed to be God. And then Kreef has a fifth historical argument, and this is Christ himself, the life of Christ himself, the historical events surrounding Christ himself. Kreef said that what it boils down to, that Christ was either Lord, or he was a lunatic, or he was a liar. And I've heard people, historians even make one or the other of those three different claims. In fact, one of my sons who got his bachelor's degree in history probably 20 years ago or so, he had a professor in a history class who used to basically say Christ was basically a liar.
Oh.
Either liar or lunatic.
Liar or lunatic. Well, at least he was being logical because he didn't want to accept that he was God.
He'd have to accept the
other two possibly.
Yes, he would.
Okay.
And then we get into the sixth one that we didn't get into, and this is the saints, the lives of the saints, especially their joy. Kreef quotes G.K. Chesterton as saying that the only unanswerable argument against Christianity was Christians.
That's a classic statement.
Yes, and by this he meant bad and sad Christians. And similarly, Chesterton said that the only unanswerable argument for Christianity is Christians, that is, saintly Christians. Kreef says that one can argue against Mother Teresa's theology if he's skeptical of mine, and I, of course, heard people do that, and I'm sure you did too back when she was still living, or question her motives and or this and that and the other. But one can't argue against Mother Teresa herself unless he is hopelessly hard of heart. And I did hear some hopelessly hard of heart people.
Really?
Even back during her lifetime.
Really? I've never been in contact with
that. Oh, there would be people. I mean, prominent people who would make comments, skeptics, who would make comments to the effect, oh, she's just doing that to be famous or this, you know, that kind of nonsense.
I remember when she received the Nobel Peace Prize, some prominent feminine author came out and said she's just a pawn of the Pope, saying what the Pope wants to be said. And boy, she got an awful lot of flack mail on that one. That she didn't really believe that abortion was wrong, and that she didn't really believe in natural family planning, and she was just parading the party line. So I think that's a good point. You can't argue against Mother Teresa, what she did.
Well, Kreef asks that if there is no God, how could life's most fundamental illusion cause its greatest joy? If God didn't do it, who put smiles on the lips of martyrs? By their fruits you shall know them. He concludes by saying that illusions don't have the staying power that the faith has. I've been doing quite a bit of reading on the martyrs in the early church, and here lately for something I'm working on right now. And these people were either crazy or they had a powerful belief that was motivating them to go on and even, you know, suffer terrible torture with a smile on their faces. Peter Kreft is talking about it. In other words, with joy. I was reading about Saint Cecilia last night.
And, one of the great early martyrs of the Roman Church.
Yes.
I think she lie with her head partly severed for a couple of days?
About 3 days.
Because the executioner did a bad job and only had a certain amount of strokes to give.
Yeah, well, he flinched because he didn't really want to do it, and so he just about half cut her head off. Mm-hmm. And the poor thing, she had on this beautiful gown, and the blood, she bled all over it. And there's been some considerable debate over the centuries about whether she ever really existed and this, that, and the other, but her tomb was opened on two different occasions. The last time in 1599. It may have been open since then, but that's a well-attested viewing of her body at that time. The Pope was present, and the leading cardinal was present, and some very, very credible people were present when this was done. And what they found there was what they really fit in with what the story was. This is what many people thought maybe was nothing more than a legend.
Sure. Well, that's encouraging to hear. There's a beautiful statue, marble statue, of Saint Cecilia lying in death on the floor after the botched execution, or flinched, as you said, and wasn't able to kill her completely.
I think Saint Perpetua and Saint Agatha, I believe the
same.
Felicity. Yeah, their martyrdom before was similar too. In fact, one of them was the executioner flinched when he tried to kill her, and she lingered on until she was, I think, stabbed or something later on to kill her.
Well, certainly the saints have been the greatest testimony and witnesses and shining lights for the existence of God.
Well, you look at the first, 20 popes. I know for sure the first 12, but I'm almost sure up until
almost
the 300s, almost all of those 300. Were martyrs, up until the time of Constantine.
Right. Yeah, I think every one of them was.
Yes, I think you're probably right.
Well, I don't know whether I should throw this in or not, but what would we say about these people, these terrorists who blow themselves up as a witness to their conviction that this is, I'm serving God, I'm serving the Lord of the universe. A person can certainly be malformed in their thinking.
That's an interesting question. I remember back after, right after 9/11, and some of my discussions in my various classes, because the kids, you know, wanted to talk about it, and they had all kinds of questions. I prepared about a 2 or 3 session discussion dealing with why does God allow bad things to happen to good people. That question came up at the time, and one student rather perceptively said, well, yeah, but these people believed that what they did was right, and when they died, they would go to, you know, to heaven. And what about that, Mr. Elder? And I said, well, what they did was intrinsically evil, you know, taking lives, whether they be innocent or not. Yeah, on self-defense and this, that, and the other, a person, of course, is can take a life, but certainly not in a wanton way. The thought was, of course, but nonetheless, these people believe that they were doing something good, and that when they died, they go to paradise. How about that? And, well, if I recall right, my answer was at the time, well, of course, we don't know. If a person does what his conscience tells him to do, and he really sincerely believes that he's doing something to please God, in this case, the Arabic way of looking at God, Allah, then who do we just say that they don't go to paradise? In other words, are they going to, the moment that their soul leaves their body, are they going to go to hell forever? I don't know, of course. We don't know.
Well, hasn't the church always taught that if a person is really following their conscience to the best of their ability, that's what God judges them on. But the problem is, I think you can make an argument that Hitler was probably following his conscience in the destruction of the Jews. Stalin was probably following his conscience in the destruction of the Ukrainians and bringing communism and the hammer and sickle to try to rule the world. So it's something we have to leave to God.
Yes, but, you can't give it certainly give a definitive answer.
But we certainly, that's why it's so important that the truth will make us free. That's what Jesus said, that it's so important for us to be aware of what is right and what is wrong.
Yes.
Okay, well, but at least the martyrs gave their lives unknowingly and willingly, fidelity to Jesus. The apostles gave their lives as witnesses to the resurrection.
Well, as you know, in these fundamentalist terrorist groups, they call these people martyrs.
Sure, I'm sure they do. And I think they appeal to them that way.
Yes, they do.
We need martyrs for the cause.
Yeah, you wouldn't think a person would lightly give their life, and I don't think they do, but obviously we still don't agree with them.
From
looking at it certainly from a Christian perspective, it's an intrinsically evil.
Well, and deliberately killing innocent people.
Like men, women, children, and whoever else. Yeah.
And purposely just for the cause.
Yes.
Okay, well, how about Peter Kreeft has another argument about the conversion of the world. Now, I suppose, in looking at this one, we'd have to say a lot of that conversion has turned into sort of backsliding.
Well, in this regard, Kreeft asked the question, how can we explain the success of the faith in winning the hearts of men?
And he's looking at historically.
He's looking at historically, certainly. And take, for example, during the first three or four centuries when the church was, for the most part, under terrible persecution under various Roman emperors and in other places in the world as well, but especially in the Roman Empire. He says that hard-hearted Romans gave up worldly pleasures and ambitions and often life itself to follow Jesus. And how can we explain worldly men pinning their hopes on other worldly goals and doing it consistently, in mass, century after century, until the whole civilized Western world is converted, if Christianity is not true, and there are no miracles. He says that this record is an even greater miracle itself, this conversion of the world. Christianity, certainly by the Middle Ages, it spread almost everywhere in the world, to the ends of the world. The apostles, it's believed that Thomas went even to India. Later on in the 16th century, you had Saint
Francis Xavier,
and you had other great missionaries going all the way to Japan and even into China. Certainly in the Spanish colonies, and later on with the English and the French, missionaries went into all of North and South America. Christianity actually did literally go to the ends of the world. It is true that there are places in the world where Christianity never really took root very well. It's really too bad. For example, in the East, and I read a few things about why, what militated against the spread and the acceptance and the spread of Christianity in the Far East. And that's an interesting point, which we don't have time to go into right now. But what I found is, though, those Orientals who do become Catholics, boy, they usually become really good Catholics, usually very Orthodox and very people who try to live, very holy lives. whether they be Japanese or Chinese or Indians or whoever they are. And I've always thought, boy, it's really too bad that, Christianity never really took root in, let's say, India or Japan or China and places like that.
I think there was a strong presence of the Christian faith in Korea. A lot of Korean martyrs in the days.
And most of the Koreans that I personally have known have been very devout Catholics.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand now, aren't we seeing a demise of what is called the de-Christianization of the Western world?
Yeah, we're finding that in Europe and in the United States. That is probably more explained by increased standard of living.
Standard of living.
People become more affluent, they tend to, for some reason or another, to become more secular, more materialistic, more hedonistic, in other words, in the search of pleasure.
It was the whole repeating of Jewish experience.
That's exactly true.
As the chosen people prospered, they began to get into idolatry. And then the prophets, as you mentioned last time, came in, pulled them back again, then they came back to God. So I remember a Luther minister told me one time when I was visiting a church looking at new churches, he said, the only thing the human being cannot survive is prosperity. And you'd think that's the one thing that would be a great blessing for us.
Yes.
But we certainly have to struggle with that and with our fallen human nature.
Well, you can see this even in countries like Ireland, had a history of being very devout Catholic. And now that Ireland is beginning to become more affluent, you're beginning to see the same kind of secularism and materialism and hedonism creeping in there.
Unfortunately,
and
so.
And they get soft on abortion and
divorce and other issues.
Yes.
All those issues, homosexuality.
Yes,
yes, it was the missionary bullseye of the church, sending missionaries to the whole known world, Ireland, and then as it became the new economic tiger, or the economically great prosperity, they're facing the same problems that we face in the United States.
Very similar. Well, to drive his point home, Creef says that Greek philosophy won converts through rational proofs, and Muhammad through force of arms, and the jihad or holy war, and Christ though won hearts by the miracle of amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. And of course he's here quoting John Newton's famous song of that name, Amazing Grace.
That is a powerful song, and most of us probably don't know the history of it, how it was written by a slave trader after he was converted at sea and calling out, God save me and I'll change my lifestyle. And he went and became an Anglican minister.
Yes.
And he wrote that and other beautiful hymns. A lot of people don't like to say that saved a wretch like me, but John Newton meant what he said.
Yes.
I was a wretch. And so the author certainly meant that word to apply to him specifically. Okay, well, Peter Creef has even other arguments, which I think is very very subtle and very appealing.
His last argument is just our own life experiences. We've been talking about these experiential historical arguments. And he tells us that the Christian faith is verifiable in a laboratory, but it's a subtle and complex laboratory. It is the laboratory of one's life. He says that he always tells a skeptic to pray, the prayer of the skeptic, he calls it, if he really wants to know whether God exists. He says that it is the scientific thing to do, to test a hypothesis by performing the relevant experiment. And he states that if God exists, he wants to get in touch with us and reveal himself to us, and that he has promised that all who seek him will find him. Creef concludes that all the agnostic has to do is to sincerely seek, honestly and with an open mind, and he will find. in God's way and in God's time. And that's part of the hypothesis.
I went to a Sacre Coeur, or Sacred Heart, on Montmartre, the Mountain of Martyrs in Paris. There's this tremendous marble white church that's open day and night, but they have in the back there, in about 12 different languages, prayer for those who don't believe in God. And it says the very same thing. God, I don't even know if you exist, but if you do, please help me. And it was an attempt to take a person where they were, because the night and day people come in there for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. Bishop Sheen had a lot of wonderful stories about his visits to Montmartre or Sacre Coeur in Paris. Well, how does the skeptic, I'm not sure, how does the skeptic find God?
Well, Kraft says that not just by arguing, but also by praying. And not just by talking about God, but also by talking to God. His advice to the unbeliever is to go out into his backyard some night and say to the empty universe above him, God, I don't know whether you exist or not. Maybe I'm praying to nobody, but maybe I'm praying to you. So if you're really there, please let me know somehow, because I do want to know. I want only the truth, whatever it is. If you are the truth, here I am, ready and willing to follow you wherever you lead. End of quote. Kreeft believes that if our faith is not a pack of lies, then whoever sincerely prays that prayer will find God in his or her own life, no matter how hard, long, or complex the road. He completes his discussion on historical proofs for God's existence by quoting St. Augustine's Confessions. Quote, all roads lead to Rome. Quote, if only we follow them. End of quote.
Okay, well, that brings us to the sort of a natural conclusion in our series. How do we find God by reason? And we talked about St. Thomas's arguments. We talked about experiential arguments from mystical practices. And we're going to bring up next time the scientific proofs about the existence of God. So once again, thanks to all our listeners for being with us. May God bless you always and in all ways.